The series is sponsored by Jake and Karen Abelevitz in memory of Le'iloi Nishmas, Jake's parents, Eliyahu ben Abba, and Leah Bas Avraham. And in the zchus of our learning together, may their neshamas have a great zchus and a great aliyah. Okay. Sefer Vayikra is a tough sefer. It deals with the karbanos, the sacrifices, and thing the goings-on in the Mishkan. And it is it's tough, you know, it's tough going to slog through many psukim that deal with this carbon and that carbon and the other carbon without having really a full, a fuller and more deeper appreciation. It's not a story. It's a lot of technicalities here. Having said that, I do want to focus today on one of the karbanos, and hopefully offer a message or suggest a message that we learn from the karban that is relevant and applicable to us in our lives today. Even though we are without a Beis HaMikdash, without a Mishkan, we do not have karbanos. But yet I do believe that there is something worthwhile and compelling to learn, a message which is embedded within the karbanos generally and within the particular karban that I would like to talk about today. So there are a variety of karbanos. We have, anybody know some of the karbanos that are that are offered?
Olah, atat.
Yeah, so we have a karban ola. It's a burnt offering. It entirely goes up in the on the mizbeach. We have an asham, which is a guilt offering. We have a chatas, which is a sin offering. What exactly are the differences between a guilt offering and a sin offering? But okay, you have those two. What else do you have? Karban shlamim. A karban shlamim, as opposed to a karban ola, has there are three partners in the karban shlamim. Part of it is burned on the mizbeach. Part of it is consumed, is eaten by the kohen, and part of it is consumed, is eaten by the by the individual who is bringing the karban shlamim. Then we have we have karbanos like karban pesach. And I shouldn't say like karban pesach. It is rather unique karban pesach. But we have karban pesach. You have the shalmei chagiga, the shalmei simcha. Those are shlamim offerings. So, if you know the answer to this question, I would ask you just to answer it based on what you think, not based on what you know. A karban chatas, would you think that it is that a karban chatas is a karban which is eaten, consumed, or is burned on the mizbeach? Right, a karban chatas is a sin offering. A person does a sin, and as a consequence, they have to bring this this karban. For example, a person violates Shabbos. So if a person violates Shabbos b'mezid intentionally, so there's a terrible punishment, a capital punishment. If a person is convicted in Beis Din, he could get, he could get the death penalty, and or kares is the big one when it comes to Shabbos. A person does a by. I don't say exactly by accident, but unintentional. So he brings a karban chatas, right? If all types of things in the Torah, there are various punishments that are offered. So when you bring a karban chatas, would you suggest that a karban chatas in response to having done an unintentional avera is a karban that you eat, or a karban which is burned on the mizbeach?
You would burn it on the mizbeach because you don't want to consume something that you've done an avera on, even if it's unintentional.
Okay.
That's what I think.
Okay. I think there's great logic to that. Yeah. Barbara?
I think that if it is unintentional, I think that part should be for Hashem and part should be for him. But if it's intentional.
Why, if it's unintentional, should part be for him. The guy did an avera. The guy did a sin. He's bringing a karban, and now he should eat from the karban that is sort of representative of the sin that he did.
Well, it's because unintentional.
So, I understand it's unintentional, but I'm saying, well, let me ask you the question this way. If it was, let's say you brought a karban for an intentional sin. Let's just say for a second. Why does it make sense to you that that would be going entirely to Hashem?
As a kapara.
So for an unintentional sin, you only need half a kapara?
Maybe.
Okay, maybe. Right. Yeah, go ahead, Judy.
I'll say first that you gave away the answer to this in the title, but
I was counting on nobody actually reading the emails, so sorry, Judy.
Yeah, some of us do.
Yeah.
But it also, it's owning, eating it is owning what you've done.
Okay.
That's it.
Okay. So it is interesting that a karban chatas is eaten. It's actually consumed by the kohen. The kohanim eat it. So whatever symbolism we derive from it is it's symbolism because the if I'm not mistaken, but I think the psukim say that it's eaten by the kohen, not by the individual. Nevertheless, whether it's whoever is eating it, even if it is eaten by the individual or the kohen. There is an element here of symbolism of the karban being consumed, being eaten. And the question is, for me, why does that make sense? If it's a karban shlamim, karban shlamim, that's a happy karban, right? So, yeah, that makes sense on some level that the person is going to eat it. But karban chatas is associated with sin and all of that. Why I tend to agree with Esther's analysis and say that really it should be all burned and all and offered entirely on the mizbeach. So there are a few ways to address this question, and I'm gonna come back to Judy what you said. I think that's entirely true. But in order to understand what a karban chatas is, I think we have to understand what the word chatas means. So what does the word chatas mean?
To miss the target.
Okay, to miss the target, yeah. What else?
From chait, isn't it?
Chait. Chait, a sin. Okay, so a chait means a sin. To miss a target when a person sins, so they're sort of, missing the target, as it were. All right. Anybody else? What does chatas mean?
Right.
Okay, so I think that's pretty clear that chatas comes from the word chait, which means sin, or its variant, missing the target, which is what a sin is. But, if we refer to a sin as missing the target, it's slightly less condemnatory and guilt-provoking than if we say a sin is a sin. Missing the target, okay, people miss the target. But if we say it's a sin, that has a little bit more guilt associated with it. But either way, chatas comes from the word chet, or does it? So let me share my screen with you, and we're going to take a look at a couple of different approaches. Okay. All right, we're going to start here with, let's see if I can get my screen. We're going to start here with Vayikra, Perek Hey, Pasuk Tesvav. So I have to unshare my screen with you. For some reason, I know it's like every time I do this, it's like the first time I've ever done it, but some reason when my screen is shared, to manipulate my screen and move things around becomes a little more difficult. So let's...
Remember those days.
Yeah. V'nefesh ki techeta v'shama kol alav. A person incurs a guilt, sins. And he hears a public imprecation or some type of curse. V'hu eid or ra'ah yada im lo yada yagid v'nasa avono. If he does not give the information, if he does not provide the information, then he accepts the punishment. All right, let's move on a little bit. O nefesh ki tiga b'chol davar tameh, o b'nivlas chaya tmeya. If a person touches an impure thing, v'ne'alam imenu v'hu tameh v'ashem, he will be impure. Etc., etc. You know, lots of interesting things going on here. Pasuk 5, haya ki yesham lachas me'ela v'zvada asher chata leha. Upon realizing the guilt of these matters, a person should confess that he sinned. So the word chet, it clearly has to do with sin, violation, guilt, you know, things of that nature. But now I want to move here to, let's see, to Pasuk, Pasuk, where are we? Okay, Pasuk 14. Vayidaber Hashem el Moshe le'mor. Hashem speaks to Moshe. Nefesh, same parak, parak 5. Nefesh kitim ol ma'al v'chata b'shkaga. When a person commits some type of violation, v'chata b'shkaga, and he sins unintentionally, mikadshe Hashem, about one of the sacrifices, one of the kodshim, the sacred things, the heviyas hashamo l'ashem ayel tamim min atzon be'arkecha kesef shkalim b'shekel hakodesh la'asham. So a person does some type of a violation of sanctity, of the mishkan, or whatever it is. He does so unintentionally, so he brings a karban. The esa sher chata min hakod. And the word here in the pasuk is kitim olmal v'chata b'shkaga v'hevi es ashamo. He brings a karban asham. Right, so he did some type of trespass, some type of violation, and he has to bring this karban asham. V'esasher yachta min hakodesh yishalem. A person shall make restitution for the remission regarding the sacred things that he violated. Right, he defiled some type of sacred thing, so he has to make restitution. V'nasana kol kohen v'asham v'nislach lo. Okay, so let's take a look here. What is the meaning of the word asham, a guilt offering, and what is the meaning of the word chet or chata or chatas, which is a sin offering? So let me share with you the Ramban. I'm actually going to share with you here. This is quoted in a article by Rabbi Yonatan Grossman. And part of today's shir is based on Rabbi Grossman's article. And here we have the Ramban. I'll make it a little larger on your screen. Says the Ramban. Whoops. Sorry, guys. Nope, still can't move it. Try it again. Yeah, I'm trying to move it. It's not moving, so I have to make it smaller. Okay. Nira be'enai, the Ramban says the following. Ki shem asham more al davar gadol asher ha'oso yitchayev lihiyot shamem va'aved bo. Asham is something that indicates some type of guilt that the person did, that he's now, he now has some type of obligation as a consequence of that guilt. Milashon he'eshimam elokim. And he brings a similar phrase in Tanakh, or vayeshamu neos midbar, or teesham shamron ki marasa ba alashem. In all of these situations, this is the word Hashem. However, chat v'chein Hashem imanachnu, we are guilty, ne'en Hashem, they are punished. So the word ashem has to do with guilt, has to do with some type of negative connotation here. However, chatas more al davar natabo min haderech. And this is what somebody said before. Chatas has to do with with you know, moving off, going off, literally going off the derech. Milashon hashara v'lo yachti. I'm not familiar with that pasuk. So the Ramban says the difference between a chet and an asham, right, is simply that a chet means off the derech. It doesn't quite have that same feeling of guilt and condemnation. And I think that if we understand that that's what the word chatas means, so a karbon chatas is therefore attempting to help the person get back on the straight and narrow, to get back on the derech. Now, if that is the case, I think what Judy said is entirely correct. Well, let me say it in two ways. Number one is that if a karbon chatas is about helping the person sort of retrain themselves back to the proper path, it's not about condemnation. In fact, if that is the case, then the karbon chatas is really not so much, is not just about helping the person to repair his sin, to atone for a sin, but it's actually helping the person back in the, you know, back in the tent, as it were. And so, to me, it makes sense that a karbon chatas would not be something that's burned entirely on the mizbeach. Because something which is burned entirely on the mizbeach has the connotation of destruction, of you know, finality to it. It doesn't really have much of a warm, welcoming, gentle spirit to it. But a karbon chatas, if a karbon chatas is consumed, it lowers the temperature, if you will, on the severity and intensity of this experience. It becomes less of an experience of condemnation and reparation from condemnation, in as much as it becomes more of an experience of realigning oneself on the proper path. Right? If somebody is disciplined, there are two ways. Let's say a teacher can discipline a student, or a judge can discipline a perpetrator of a crime, right? One is to throw the book at them, and the other is to, you know, to try to embrace them and help them on the derech. So it seems to me that a karbon chatas, which has to do with committing a sin, albeit intentionally, there's something, a very powerful message here, that if chatas means off the derech, then it's not that much to get, you know, it's like just a little reorientation. And this is really something to celebrate. So maybe it's entirely appropriate to have a meal, you know, to have a meal as part of the ritual. It's more welcoming. It's more inviting. It opens the door to a greater possibility of the person reuniting with, you know, with himself, with God, and getting on the right path. The door has been opened. The door doesn't have to be pried open. So I think that eating a karbon chatas from this perspective makes a lot of sense. I would also suggest that I think what Judy said is entirely correct as well. If the idea of a karbon chatas is that the person sinned, whether you want to call it off the derech or whatever, if the idea is about sin, well, and some measure of guilt, well, I think what Judy said is right, that the only way a person can really undo their guilt is to first take ownership over it. And this is symbolized through the consumption of the karbon, right? First, you have to literally own it. And what could better demonstrate the owning of the sin than eating it, as it were, eating the karbon? This is a symbolism. Just as the karbon has to be consumed, I, the individual, have to assimilate, own, take, you know, make it part of me, as it were, the sin that I have done. And once I do that, I can let go of it. Then I can... Oops, what's that? Sorry, my I had to plug in my computer. It almost died. All right. So I think what Judy is saying is absolutely correct if we take a look at this from the perspective of sin and so on. Yeah, Barbara.
So what's between ma'al and chet?
Ma'al is a particular type of violation when a person defiles something in the Mishkan, like a you use something which is kodesh for profane purposes. Okay. Right, so ma'al means that you break a boundary. Right, a chet means a sin, but ma'al is a particular kind of a breaking of a boundary. Okay, but this is what the Ramban says, and I want to share with you another perspective of what the word chet means, or what the word chatos means.
Rabbi, I want to know what type of sin it is, like chet belad lot sin.
I'm sorry.
What kind of a sin? There are lot of sins that one could do, right?
Yeah.
Right,
so what exactly it triggers a carbon chatas? I don't really want to get into it. I'm not looking at this from the halachic perspective, right? Just simply from a philosophic perspective of the psukim. The Chazal say that you only bring a carbon chatas for something for which, had you done it intentionally, you would get this you would get the punishment of karis. But that's not my issue right now. My issue is just looking at the idea of what a carbon chatas represents. Okay, so let's go back now to Perek Dalad. Let's see, do I have it up here? No. Perek Dalad, Pasuk Gimel. Okay, Perek Dalad, Pasuk Gimel. So here, Pasuk says the following: Vaydaber Hashem al Moshe Lemor, Daber al Bnei Yisrael Lemor, Nefesh ki techta b'shkaga. Speak to the people and say, when a person unintentionally does a some type of chet, mikol mitzvos Hashem, from all the mitzvos of Hashem, asher lo te'asena, that shall not be done, v'yasa me'achat mehena, and he does one of these prohibited activities. So im ha'kohen ha'mashiach yachet al hashmasa'am, if it is the kohen ha'mashiach who has incurred this this guilt, who has done the violation, v'hikriv al chatasa asher chata par ben bakar tamim l'Hashem chatas. So then he shall offer for the sin which he is guilty of a par for the chatas. Ve'vias ha'par al pesach ol moed. He brings the par to the doorway of the Ol Moed, etc. Now, vilakach. So here we have the pasuk telling us that im hakohen hamashiach yecheta l'ashmas ha'am, he shall bring a par ben bakar tamim lechatas. Okay, so what is the chatas? Take a look at a interesting commentary here, known as Shadal. Okay. All right. And he says the following. Chatas, hi asham. Hi asham. It's the same thing as an asham. Ach, however, nikra chatas, it's called a chatas. Why? Kishe osin bo chitui al karnos hamizbeach. Chitui. Right? Umipnei shekarim lahaza chitui. So the idea of chatas is that it comes from the word chitui. What does the word chitui actually mean? What does the word chitui mean?
Is it spring?
So if you look in the psukim where it comes up, and as it is translated, and if you look in the concordance to give you the term chatas of chitui, so apparently this means like to purge or to cleanse. Karbon chatas is about purging and cleansing. Right? Nikra karbon zechatas lo mipnei sheba al chet. Not because of the sin. Right? But it's about the purging and the cleansing. So maybe this is just two sides of the same coin, but I think that Shadal is saying something significantly different than the Ramban. Ramban is saying this is about sin and maybe fixing the sin. Shaddal is saying the term chatas, and thus the karban chatas, is about purging and cleansing. So, again, if it's about purging and cleansing, I would still think that that Judy's approach is correct. If you really want to purge yourself of a character trait, of a behavior, of some type of issue in your life, the first thing you have to do is take ownership over it, and then only then can you actually get rid of it. But if you don't take ownership over it, and you assume that it's something which is external to you, then it will never be gone. So the way to purge, the way to cleanse oneself, is first to take ownership. And therefore, again, the idea of eating a karban chatas, I think, is entirely resonant and compelling, right? Because we want to assume ownership, and then we can expel it. Then we can cleanse ourselves. All right, but there is, I think, another element here, and that is that when we talk about purging or cleansing, so purging and cleansing in Judaism is, we're not talking about a physical purging and cleansing, we're talking about a spiritual purging and cleansing. So what's the word that we use to refer to something which is contaminated, spiritually contaminated?
Tameh.
Something which is tameh. So let's take a look at Vayikra, Pasuk, Perek 16. Go to Vayikra 16. Vayikra 16. Pasuk 16. Vayikra 16. 16. So look at the pasuk says here. Let's go back. Let's start from 15. V'shachat asir hachatas asher la'am. He shall slaughter the people's goat of a sin offering. V'asaz damo kasher asal adam apar. V'izao sal ha-kaparas lufnei ha-kaparas. And you do a sprinkling of the blood. V'chiper ala kodesh. And he shall purge, he shall, the shrine, mitum aso, from its impurity. V'mipishehem l'chol chatosehem. V'chein yaseh la'ol moed b'toch tumasam. So you're taking this... chatas, right? The previous pasuk, v'shachat asir chatas. You're taking this chatas and you're using its blood for sprinkling. What is the purpose of the sprinkling of this blood? V'chiper, and as the English, the JPS, translates it, it means purging. V'chol adam lo yihye ba'ohel moed, b'vo l'chaper ba'kodesh, v'chiper bado uva'ad beso uva'ad kol Yisrael. So the idea of the karban chatas is about cleansing, spiritually cleansing and purging the place or the person. V'yatzah al ha-mizbeach asher lifnei Hashem, lakach midam ha-par, v'nasan al karnos ha-mizbeach. He shall go out on the altar, and he's going to cleanse, he's going to purge the altar. V'yizah alav min adam be'etzba'o, v'tiaro v'kitcho mitumas b'nei Yisrael. And the rest of the blood shall be sprinkled with his finger seven times, thus he shall purify it of the defilement of the Bnei Yisrael and consecrated. So here we have the notion of purging, of cleansing, of purifying. V'chilami mikhaperes hakodesh, and when he has finished purging the Mishkan, then v'hikrivis hasa'ir achai, then he shall go and bring out the live goat, etc. And this is, of course, if you don't remember the context here, we're talking about a karban for Klal Yisrael and Yom Kippur. Okay, so we see here the idea of chatas is the idea of purging, purifying, and cleansing. Let's take a look at one other example of this, just as a proof that this is so. And I think this is a very compelling proof. Go to Bamidbar 19. Go to Bamidbar 19. Pasuk, start from Pasuk 9. This is Parshas Chukas. And what is the big mitzvah in Parshas Chukas that we're all aware of?
Para
Aduma. Para Aduma, right? What is a Para Aduma used for?
Hapara.
Right. The Para Aduma, the red heifer, is used for the purposes of when a person is tame, when a person is spiritually impure, right? They've come in contact with a dead body, for example, with a corpse, or they become tame. So if a person wants to become tahor, he goes through a process of the Para Aduma. So let's read the psukim. The one who gathers up the ashes of the paraduma shall also wash those clothes and be impure until evening, and this shall be a permanent law for the Israelites. Hanogea b'meis l'chol nefesh, whoever touches a dead body, v'tamei shivas yamim, will be tamei for 7 days. Hu yischatabo. What does the word here mean? This cannot mean sin, right? The person shall purify themselves with the ashes of the paraduma. Hu yischata bo. Bayom ashlishi u bayom ashvi, on the third day, on the seventh day, they purify themselves. Vim lo yischata. And if he fails to purify himself on the third and the seventh day, lo yitar, he cannot become tahor. Kol hanogea b'meis b'nefesh ha'adam asher yamus, the lo yischata, those who touch a corpse, the body of a person who has died, and do not purify themselves. Chet here does not mean sin. It doesn't mean going off the derech. It doesn't mean missing the mark. Chet over here very clearly means purification. So if a person, the lo yischata, and they do not purify themselves, as Mishkan Hashem Time, then their presence defiles the Mishkan, the Nichrisa Nefesh Ahimi Yisrael. So, and the person gets a terrible punishment of Kares. So it's an amazing thing. It's an amazing thing. The word Chet, while when we used it in the context of the Karban Chatas, you know, maybe some of you were saying to yourselves, maybe it's a stretch. Maybe Chatas, to say that it means to purify with a psukim that we referenced a moment ago, you know, maybe you could read it two ways, but here I don't think you can read it two ways. Here it is absolutely clear. The term yischata means, or chet, chitui, means to purify. So if the term chatas can mean purification, so what is a person being purified from? Tumah. Spiritual contamination. So what is Tumah and Tahara? What exactly is Tumah and Tahara? Right. Is Tumah a bad thing? Is Tumah a bad thing?
It's a negative.
Apparently it is. Well, not apparently. I'm asking you. Is it? Do you think that Tumah is a negative thing? Think. All right. Well, that's sort of like a backhanded compliment, right?
Okay.
All right. It is a good thing because it leads to tahara, right? Sinning leads to tshuva, so sinning is a good thing. All right. Maybe on some level it is, you know. Judy.
It's not a bad thing in itself. It's inappropriate in certain circumstances.
Yeah, inappropriate in certain circumstances. Like, for example, if you're walking into the Beis Hamikdash, it's inappropriate. But it's more than inappropriate. You get kares, right? Isn't that what it said? So, okay, so in that context, it is a terrible, terrible thing. But is Tumah in and of itself a bad thing? Can anybody think of a situation where there's a mitzvah to become tameh?
Yeah, to take care of a dead person.
Yeah, how about taking care of a dead person? And that's considered one of the greatest chasadim to do. This is not just a necessary evil. And if a person is a kohen who's not allowed to become tameh, right, because of his, he's not supposed to become tameh because he has to eat truma and he has got to go to the mikdash and all these things, right? So a Kohen is not supposed to become Tameh, and And yet, even a Kohen, in the context of having an immediate relative who's died, there's a mitzvah for them to defile themselves. So Tumah is not in and of itself a bad thing. Indeed, let's take a look at Vayikra Yud Zayin. I know we're skipping around a bunch here, but bear with me. Vayikra Yud Zayin. Okay, Vayikra Yud Zayin. Pasuk 16. Okay. Yud Zayin 16. What does the pasuk say? Okay. Right. V'chol ha-nefesh, we'll go back to Pesukim. V'chol nefesh asher tochal nevelo treifa. Any person who eats what has died or has been born by beast shall wash his clothes, bathe in water, remain impure until evening, and then shall be pure. V'chol v'im... But if the clothes are not washed and the body is not bathed, the person shall bear the guilt. So what are we talking about here? A person who engages with some type of animal carcass is tameh? What's the big deal? What's the big deal with that?
That's Rashi too. It's in Shmini also, I think.
Yeah. So take a look at what Rashi has to say over here. If you don't do this, v'nasa avono, then you are guilty. So how does Rashi explain this? Says Rashi, v'nasa avono, im yochal kodesh, in the context, if you're going to eat a karban, o yikanes lamikdash, you're going to go to the mikdash, and you're tameh, then that is a sin. But, but barring that, there's really no problem with a person who's not a Kohen to become tummy. So tumah in and of itself doesn't seem to be really such a terrible thing. And yet, we saw that if a person goes into the Beis HaMikdash, it becomes a hugely terrible thing, and the person can get karis for it. So. So my question is, what exactly is the issue that makes Tumah so horrendous in the context of the Mishkan, in the context of going into the Mikdash, in the context of Karbanos? What exactly is really so terrible here?
You want an answer?
If you'd like to suggest one, I'll be happy to.
When a person is Tumah, it's not the worst thing in the world. But if he's going to a place that's pure Kedusha and he's bringing the Tumah into it, it's Metameh the Makom, and that is a serious problem. So you can't do that. You have to cleanse yourself. And if you don't cleanse yourself, the serious thing is that he gets the kares.
Okay.
He gets serious punishment.
So I like what you're saying.
The Tumah may not be so terrible, but there is a way out, and that is to be metaneh himself from the tumah.
Okay.
Otherwise, we don't live with tumah.
Got it. So my challenge to that, and I hear what you're saying, it's not so terrible, but bringing into a place which is holy and defiling that space makes it is really bad, and you didn't cleanse yourself and all of that. My challenge to that, however, is that. But so what? Okay, so you defile the space. It's fixable. So, right, if you soil a shirt, you bring it to the cleaners, so you fix it. What makes this so egregious? You're right. I mean, it's not nice. It's not nice. He went in and defiled the space, so now the Kohanim have to worry about cleaning it up and sanctifying it. But what is so necessarily egregious about defiling? What does it mean even? What does it mean that a person who is tameh defiles the space? What are those words? I know what the words translate to, But what is the mean? What is the meaning of it? I'm asking.
The problem is that the person is not respecting the makom. It's the same thing as
good. I'll take that. I'll take that. It's a lack of respect. Okay, I got it. It's a lack of respect. I totally get that. It's a disrespect. It shows lack of respect. But you know what? If a person goes into the to the mikdash, if a person goes into the mikdash, and they show that disrespect, does it really demand kares? So maybe yes. Maybe that's such a level of disrespect that it demands this type of response. I can't hear you. I cannot hear you properly. Right. We have a bad connection. I can't really hear you. Yeah. Okay. I'm sorry, but it's all garbled. I can't really hear you. All right. So I want to suggest that to explain a little bit better or a little bit differently, what is so egregious about Tuma meeting Tahara? So Esther says it's about disrespect, and I get that, and that certainly makes sense. But there's another level here, and that is, what does Tuma represent? So what does Tuma represent? If you think about it,
Tuma, there's two things that are coming together. One is about the place of Hashem, or the place of the divine, and the other is about our finite space. And they can't come together except under very special circumstances that have to be paid quite strict attention to.
And
one is God's space, and one is man's space.
So what is man's space?
Well, we're finite.
Okay.
We're physical and corporeal.
Okay, I get it. So why does Tuma? So I'm not sure of the point that you're making, Marjorie.
Well, it's hard for the whole point of the whole book of Leviticus is that after the sin of the golden calf, we had to find a way for us to approach the divine without incurring these terrible punishments or being so frightened. We needed to connect and relate to Hashem and come into relate to him, but it had to be guarded under certain circumstances, and that's what all these boundaries and rules are about.
All right, so the boundary that could be true. But if that's the case, there could be all types of boundaries. I'm trying to understand what is the natural repulsion between Tuma and Tahara, other than it being a rule that has to be kept. Is it more than just a rule that has to be kept, or is there something organic to Tuma which makes it incompatible with Tahara? So What does Tuma generate from? What is the genesis of Tuma? Good. So Tuma has to do with death, right? The Avi Avos HaTuma, the granddaddy of all Tumas, is a dead body, right? Is a corpse. Tuma represents death. Now, if Tuma represents death, then that is the antithesis of Tahara. Tahara is the place of the Makom Kodesh, I should say, is the place of the divine. The divine is the source of all life. So Tuma is not compatible with Makom Kodesh, with the place of Hashem, because Hashem is about life and Tuma is about death. So it's not simply that it's disrespectful for somebody who's tamei to violate that space. It's not simply that we are given sort of guidelines and guide rails in order to enter this space, but there's something organic about tumah that makes it incompatible and reprehensible, because death and life are two opposites. I mean, I know a person has to, you know, death we say is part of life, but death is, and I thought, Marjorie, this is maybe where you were going, but death is finite. Death is finite, and Hashem is infinite. Death represents the limitations of man, and life represents the limitlessness of Hashem. So tumah and the makom kodesh are entirely incompatible with one another. And that's why, it seems to me, right? So let's go back for a second. Shaddal said, what is a karban chatas? Chatas comes from the word chitui, which means to purify, to cleanse, to purge. What are we cleansing ourselves of, purging ourselves of? When we talk about cleansing and purging, that's removing tumah. What does tumah have to do with sin? So it's exactly this point. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the source of all life. When we sin, we are distancing ourselves and putting a barrier or a filter between ourselves and the source of life. Sin is incompatible with Hashem. Not because it's the wrong thing to do, which it is. Not because it's disrespectful against Hashem, which it is. And not simply because of the fact that it gets us off the derech, which it does. But because sin distances us, creates a barrier or a filter between ourselves and the source of life. It is organically incompatible. And that's what makes sin, in a certain sense, a bad thing. In addition to the simple understanding of disrespectful and the disloyalty to God and all that. So why does one eat a karban chatas? I think the reason the Kohen eats a karban chatas is to symbolize that, what is a greater symbolism of life than eating, right? Eating nourishes the person, nourishes, and is what nourishes physical life. The karban chatas represents, in the eating of the chatas, a reunification with life, It's just a symbolism, so it's food, but it's the symbolism to the source of all life. When a person does tshuva, when a person repents for their sin, when a person brings the karban chatas, they are now reconnecting their battery, their plug to the electric socket. They are creating this connection back to the source of all life, the divine essence of all living things. And that's why it makes sense that you eat the karban chatas. But let's test that theory for a second. Let's think about the things which are tamei, which have to then become tahor. So there is the tumas zav and zava. These are either diseases or spiritual or bodily emissions that are associated with the reproductive organs, right? So there is a diminution, if you will, of life. So a zav and a zava have to become tahar. A nazir, right? What does a nazir do? A nazir has to bring a karban chatas. So a nazir forswears themselves from the pleasures of the life in which God has given us. So when a person does that, they bring a karban chatas at the end in order to reconnect. This is not like the divine source of life, but it's sort of reconnecting to the physical life that Hashem wants us to live. Or, for example, Tumas Nida, right? Every month on the cycle, when a child is not conceived, so that cycle is now a cycle, I don't want to say death, but it's the absence of life. It's the absence of life. It was a life-giving moment, and that life-giving moment did not produce life. And so Tumas Nida also represents this disconnect from life, which requires purification, which requires tahara. Or, for example, when a woman gives birth, there's a tumah period, and the period of tumah for giving birth to a girl is longer than the period of tumah giving birth to a boy, and I think it makes sense because as this is not my own idea, I saw this somewhere that a woman has the life bearing capability, right? And so the finitude, the finiteness of life is more pronounced, right, in the female than it is in the male. Now, there is one type of tumah which requires explanation, and that is tumas yoledas. The tumah of a woman who has given birth altogether. We explain why maybe, you know, giving birth to a girl might have greater tumah associated with it than a boy where is death associated with tumas yoledas altogether? She's given birth. Isn't that the moment of greatest life? Where's the tumah there?
Could it be that there was so much death associated with childbirth in those days?
Right. So I saw one, all modern commentaries, but one suggestion was that, childbirth is really like a brush with death. Even today, people go to a hospital under medical care to give birth. It's not a nothing burger. I know that there's some people that give birth in the bathtubs in their houses, but that's a minority, right? So it's understood that there is some measure of seriousness of when a woman gives birth. Even the halacha recognizes this. Within a few days, she's considered a person who's very, very ill. Even though it's a happy thing, but she wouldn't have to fast on a fast day. So,
if that's the reason, any kind of surgery would make you tummy.
Perhaps it might. Al pi halacha, it might. Yeah. All right.
Maybe because it's a loss to the woman from her body. It's a loss to the woman.
Yeah, it's a loss.
Okay, so I think. I think I saw that is another idea which I saw. Again, none of these are my own, but I think that that as well is sensible to me, that there is some experience of loss, even though a child is born and that's a happy thing, but the mother, and taken to a unhealthy extreme postpartum depression, there is a feeling of loss here, of loss of life. I mean, a new life has come in, but the woman who's born the child has sort of lost a life in a certain sense. So there's that piece of it as well. So let me share with you something I saw here from 1 second. Yeah, Rabbi Uri Cohen. So he writes here the following. He says, Okay. I will do these two over here. Professor Rachel Adler of Los Angeles argues that tumah is less about death and more about the transition between life and death. Tumah is the nexus point. There appears to be a departure or a transfer of vital force. One of the most powerful nexus points, therefore, is childbirth. The infant who passes from the womb into the world undergoes a transition from potential life into life itself. Okay, but here's one that I wanted to focus on. Rabbi Yehuda Herzl Hankin. Says Rabbi Hankin, to be sure, tumah is often connected with death and decay, and as such it can be seen as antithetical to the idea of Hashem, the living God. Not only death and decay are opposed to the idea of God, but birth as well. How so? Hashem does not die, but neither is he born. The flux of human life, birth and death together, is antithetical to God's immutable and eternal nature. Tumah represents the waxing as well as the waning of life and has no place in the sanctuary, the abode of the eternal. The idea of birth implies death. Anything that is born dies. So Tumas Hayoledes is connected to death because human beings are finite. Birth implies death in and of itself. So this all being the case, let's go back to where we started. Why is the Karban Chatas consumed? Right? Why does somebody eat the Karban Chatas? It's all about sin and all of that. Well, if you understand, like the Ramban, that a Karban Chatas is about being off the derech, or about guilt, or about sin, so, like Judy said, person consumes it in order to own it, and thus repair. Or, like I was saying, that it's a sort of a gentle way to bring the person back on the derech. The door is open. This is not about beating over the head and berating. But the fact that they eat the karban indicates a much more positive approach to the return process. And just merely the fact that there is such a process where a person can restore and return, that is worthy of joy. And so for all of those reasons, from the sin perspective, it makes sense that the Karban Chatas is consumed. But the Shadal says that it comes not from the word chet, sin, but it comes from the word chitui, which means to purge or to cleanse or to purify. And this, we said, if we're thinking about purification, then and where do we see this word chet meaning purification? We see it in several places, but most notably by the Parah Aduma, where the ashes of the Parah Aduma purify a person who is tamei meis. Vehischatu, I think, is it. Or by the way, I didn't show you this pasuk, but the word to refer to the cleansing waters, veranida, menida chatas. The word chatas is used there as well. So chatas, chet, is about purifying. Purifying from what? Purifying from tumah. What is tumah? Tumah represents death. Death is antithetical to Hashem because Hashem is forever and death is finite. These are and therefore, when we engage in avera, we are distancing ourselves and cutting ourselves off from the source of life. So when we do tshuva, we bring the Karban Chatas, it makes sense that the Karban Chatas is consumed, because we are consuming it in order to indicate a reconnection to the source of life in a symbolic way, just like all karbanos are symbolic. And thus, it seems to me, it makes entirely good sense that a Karban Chatas is consumed. And I think that there's a message here which is applicable to all of us. All of these are messages, I think, are applicable to us even in the days beyond Karbanos. The idea of owning one's failures in order to purge themselves of a failure. The idea that we should continue a process of tshuva and revel in it and feel that it's a joyous experience because it gives us hope and opportunity. And the idea that whenever we sin, we should not want to sin, or we should avoid sinning, not because it's wrong, which it is, or not because it's disrespectful or disloyal to Hashem, but because it's in our worst interest to sin. We are cutting ourselves off from the source of life, and who would want to do that? So even though the Karban Chatas doesn't exist anymore, I believe that the symbolism of the Karban Chatas is very relevant, even Bizman Hazeh. Barbara, you wanted to say something.
Yeah. I wanted to say, hence the word, the definition of the word karban from the word karov.